From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we look back at a decade of commercial development trends with reporter Tom Dakin. Then, how a method called intercropping can help save our agricultural soils from erosion.
There are some wonderful experiments that show that if you simply take 10% of the corn out of production and replace it with deep-rooted prairie plants, that is sufficient to reduce erosion 95%.
Our Beats Me series examines the cultural experience of being a black man in Milwaukee. Plus, we find out how local company Top Note Tonic is pouring itself into the sweet spot of consumer trends.
43% of the liquor aisle right now is premium. And that part of the liquor category continues to grow because people are just simply trading up. They might be drinking less, but they're trading up for it. And that means they're going to make a better cocktail.
Lake Effect is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. So much has changed in Milwaukee over the last decade. Over just the past few years, we've seen the Hop connect Milwaukee's downtown neighborhoods, we've seen Northwestern Mutual Tower transform the city's skyline, and we've seen Pfizer Forum redefine what is now known as the Deer District. Journalist Tom Dakin has been here through all of it, reporting on each development for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He recently wrote about the top development trends of the last decade, and he joins me in studio to talk about some of them. Tom Dakin, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you for having me.
So, past decade, a lot of things have happened in Milwaukee. And one of the big areas that I feel like keeps coming up, especially in your piece, is Milwaukee's downtown.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if you were to ask people what's happened in the 10 years in terms of development, if they were to tell someone visiting from out of town, I think the things they would talk of off the top of their head would be Pfizer Forum, the Northwestern Mutual Tower that went up a few years ago. You might toss in the Grand Avenue being renovated into completely new uses, the food hall and the offices and the apartments. And I think you'd probably talk about the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra just down the block on West Wisconsin Avenue, which is going to open next year and be, I think, huge and beautiful and have quite an impact on that part of town. But the purpose of the story that I wrote when we were looking at, I think we talked about a dozen different big development trends or stories of the past decade. I really wanted to let readers know that it's more than just downtown, that there have been things also happening in other neighborhoods. For example, the Menominee Valley, Walker's Point, the Harambe neighborhood, which I think really has been underreported, or at least a lot of people who read our paper probably aren't aware of it. And it's good to remind people that there are things happening other than downtown Milwaukee.
Well, and that's something that you highlighted in your piece. I believe you, in fact, dubbed it the underreported development story. So what has happened in the Harambe neighborhood over the past 10 years, but even in just the past few years?
Probably the thing that I think people are most aware of if they think of Harambe, and first of all, they might not even know that that's the neighborhood's called. A lot of people will call it Bronzeville. Harambe encompasses Bronzeville, but extends quite a bit ways north and south of there between roughly Holton Street and I-43. So think of the neighborhood west of River West, north of downtown. That would be Harambe. So within the Bronzeville area, for example, you've got two apartment buildings that are next to each other that developed. One, a historic redevelopment of the Garfield Avenue, former Garfield Avenue School. And then next to it, a brand new building that has space for the future America's Black Holocaust Museum that's to be opening here in early 2020. So those two collectively are next to each other, and that's a pretty high-profile development. I think most people have heard of the America's Black Holocaust Museum. Just about a block to the east, right at the corner of King Drive and North Avenue, you've got Pete's Fruit Market, which in any other neighborhood, that really wouldn't be that big of a deal. But in a neighborhood that badly wanted a grocery store with fresh food, specifically fresh produce, that was a godsend for the people living there. So that helped and is a fairly high-profile development. Aside from that, you've got some apartments that have been, again, rehabbed out of historic buildings, the Wilford Sanders lofts out of an old shoe factory, which also has an office component to it. Right next to it, you have the former 5th Street School that was rehabbed into apartments for the elderly. And then the one that I keep thinking has got a big impact and will continue to have a big impact is Bader. Bader Philanthropies moving its foundation from the historic Third Ward into Harambe on King Drive at the northern end of King Drive. So the part of King Drive that hasn't seen as much development as that portion of King Drive that's much closer to downtown. Bader basically is walking the walk. Their foundation, their funds often serve central city needs. Now they're located in the central city. And in addition to putting a substantial amount of money into that project, which involved both a historic rehab as well as new construction that was added to that building, they bought the building across the street, and they're now renovating that into a wellness clinic and a cafe. So that's, again, having a big impact in that neighborhood.
A big part of this story is something that came up a lot in the Harambe developments, apartments.
Yeah.
In neighborhoods, not just downtown, but throughout the Milwaukee area.
Right, right. Downtown, we continue to see it, but also we've seen it now spread to one area I highlighted, which is the New Harbor District, which was literally created, if you will, 2 years ago when the Common Council and Mayor Tom Barrett approved the land and water use plan for that area. For your listeners who aren't familiar with it, the Harbor District is basically part of Walker's Point and a small part of what we traditionally think of Bayview. So you think First Street, going from First Street towards the lake, starting at about where Walker's Point and the Third Ward are at the Milwaukee River, and then extending all the way south, going across the KK River to Bay Street slash Beecher Street. That's the Harbor District. A few years ago, we had Freshwater Plaza open at the corner of Water and Greenfield, right across the street from the Rockwell headquarters. That was an apartment development and had some retail added to it. We now have the River One development that's under construction as we speak, which is right on the Kinnickinnick River at the corner of First and Beecher. That's apartments, or that will be apartments. Currently, it's an office building that's under construction, but the next phase will be apartments. They'll also have a hotel there. So, yeah, we're seeing those types of projects happening in Milwaukee in neighborhoods that are, again, away from downtown. Walker's Point has had a lot of apartment development. That's probably been the single biggest, for lack of a better term, commercial development product created in Walker's Point over the past 10 years. You've had some retail as well, but the primary driver of development there has been housing.
Yeah, you mentioned Walker's Point as an area that had a lot of redevelopment over the last decade.
Right.
Has it largely been in housing? Have there been other projects?
Yeah, the housing's been the big thing. And typically the way it works in development is retail follows rooftops. Obviously, you get a growing number of people living in a neighborhood like Walker's Point. You then get the greater demand for the supermarkets, the drug stores, the restaurants, and other retail. Probably a good example of that would be the Freshwater Plaza project we talked about, which is right on the border of Walker's Point and the Harbor District, technically in the Harbor District, includes a Cermak supermarket. That's a large supermarket that is there because of those neighborhoods adding more people, as well as the people who've been living there prior to the development burst, wanting to have a place close to them, just like with Pete's Fruit Market up at the corner of King Drive and North Avenue. The other thing that's happened in Walker's Point has been, well, we've got a hotel there. That was kind of prior to this decade. The Iron Horse Hotel was built in the early 2000s. But then in addition to that, we've had this effort to develop water technology development for water technology companies. So you have the Global Water Center open within this period. Next to it, you've had the Reed Street Yards Water Technology Business Park that really hasn't launched. I mean, we've got one building there so far. That's a lot lower activity than had been hoped. But the news there is that the city has kind of moved on from trying to make that strictly for water tech companies and is now opening it up to other developments. And that's where Rite Height, the material handlers manufacturer up in Brown Deer, might be moving its headquarters from Brown Deer down to Reed Street Yards. We'll probably learn more about that in the next month or two.
Well, moving a little bit south, we get into the Bayview neighborhood. That's actually where I live.
Yes.
Even in the very short time that I've lived there, so much has changed, and it feels like a lot is still changing.
Yeah, and that really started with an apartment development called Dwell, and Dwell opened within this past decade. And that at the time was probably more risky than people appreciate now. I mean, it's easy to look back now and say, well, gee, Bayview's got all these affluent apartment dwellers. Well, someone had to take the first step, and that was HKS Development opening Dwell. You know where it is. It's on KK Avenue, practically across the street from the theater, the Avalon Atmospheric Theater, which also opened roughly around that same time. It had been closed for several years, and a gentleman by the name of Lee Barzak went in there and renovated it and reopened it and made it an attraction. He has since opened a pretty high-end restaurant, Mistral, in that space as well. So you had Dwell, you had the theater, you had Altera, now known as Colectivo, with their big investment in their coffee shop and bakery, et cetera. And then from that, now you've had more apartments built further north on KK, up closer to the entrance to Bayview, between Stitchweld and View, which opened within months of each other. That's about 350-plus apartments. And then you've got the Kinetic building that's under construction. That'll add another large number of apartments. So you've had quite a bit in Bayview and presumably could have more. There is the proposal for apartments at the site of what's now the BMO Harris Bank, but that's run into a lot of opposition from the people living there and questionable as to whether that will get approved. I know the developer is interested in pushing forward, but that still has to go through a common council review process.
The Menominee Valley has actually seen a lot of changes as well, and you describe it as adding both grit and pizzazz. What do you mean by that?
Well, the grit is the industrial portion of it. I mean, I've been here since 1991, so I'm old enough to remember what the Valley was like in the early and mid-90s, and it was basically a large, heavy industrial area that had unfortunately fallen into a lot of use, underuse, vacant lands. It used to be home to a large railroad car shop repair operation that operated for many, many decades before closing down, I think, in the 80s. But you've always had tanneries there, and those are now largely gone. You used to have a slaughterhouse down there. It's gone. And what happened was under Mayor John Norquist and then later continued by Mayor Barrett, there was an emphasis to spend a lot of city money to revitalize the area. So you took a big risk, putting a lot of money up front to buy land, do an environmental cleanup, extend Canal Street through there so you'd actually have access to these various sites. And it's paid off. I mean, it's really a national success story. The Menominee Valley Industrial Center, the city developed business park, is now completely full. You've got a dozen or so businesses down there with, you know, hundreds, over 1,000 employees. So that's the grit part. The industrial center, it's not like the heavy industrial stuff of the old era, but it's still industrial. I mean, Palermo Pizza makes pizzas. You've got companies down there that make windmill turbines and other products. The Badger Rail is down there. And then the pizzazz is sort of the other uses that we've had developed there. The Potawatomi Casino, which eventually developed a hotel, and then just in the last couple of months opened a wing to the hotel. It's one of the largest hotels in the Milwaukee area. You've had a couple of craft breweries open down there, City Lights and Third Space. And now more recently, you have this home design, home decor district that has come together with about four or five businesses, with Bachman Furniture recently opening just in the past couple of months, which gives it a real big high-profile boost. That's been a real interesting mix of uses. And one thing your listeners will notice absent from this list is housing. I mean, the city has made a definite decision with zoning to say, we don't necessarily want apartments in this area. We want it for these other uses. And I think that makes sense. You try and zone, obviously, to some extent, take into account the real world of market demand and supply. But to some extent, you also have a vision. And the vision here was to create a place that retained industrial jobs, light industrial for the most part, but industrial jobs. And quite often, that's not compatible with housing.
Yeah. So a lot of the different developments that we've talked about here are still being completed.
Right.
There's a lot of stuff that we're still, you know, waiting to see kind of the end product of, Wisconsin Avenue being one of those key places.
Yeah, yeah.
What do we have to look forward to over the next year and over the next few years?
Well, let's start with West Wisconsin Avenue. We've got the Grand Avenue. The offices are now open. The first tenant, the anchor tenant, Grafe, moved in right after the holidays. They have other leases that I suspect they'll be announcing relatively soon on the office portion of it. The food hall portion is under construction, but that's Third Street Market Hall is what that would be called. That's to open in late spring, so I would suspect by May we'll probably see an opening there. You've got the Milwaukee Symphony headquarters and the former Warner Grand Cinema that's under construction. That'll be open by the start of the symphony season, which is September. And then further west on the avenue, you've got the Wisconsin Center, which is on Wisconsin Avenue. The center is going to be expanding. The expansion itself won't be on Wisconsin Avenue. It'll be to the north onto the empty lot that they control between Wells and Kilbourne. But still, that'll have a big impact, obviously, on Wisconsin Avenue. Construction on that probably starts in 2021, but they're going to be out there. As a matter of fact, a week or so I walked by and they're doing coring, you know, drilling down to do a soil coring test. So that's something to look forward to. One of the big question marks on the avenue is still the fate of the city-owned lot that is in between the Hilton and the Grand Avenue. So that lot between 4th and 5th going south of Wisconsin, there have been proposals for hotels there predicated on a convention center expansion. So we'll see if that eventually happens. And of course, the city still wants to create an extension of the HOP that would run through part of that parcel and include a small public space, Ville Phillips Square, I believe is what they're going to be calling that.
As we look at other neighborhoods, I'm specifically thinking of the Harbor District, which
yes.
is still really under construction.
When
do we hope to see that really come to fruition?
Well, of course, right now, River One, we mentioned earlier, is under construction. The other really big Harbor District project that's about to start is Komatsu. Komatsu Mining Corporation moving their corporate campus to the end of Greenfield Avenue, right on the harbor. The environmental cleanup work, I think, is now done or will be finishing soon, and that work should begin in earnest pretty soon. I mean, by later this year, you're going to see buildings rising out of the ground at the Komatsu site. So in terms of when it gets wrapped up, I mean, first phase of River One, the office building for Michaels Corporation's Milwaukee Area Operations, they're the developer as well, that'll be open by this summer. Second phase with apartments and hotels, let's put that down for roughly end of 2021. Komatsu, I think you're probably talking end of 21, early 22 for that project to be done.
So still a lot more to look forward to
as
we move forward here.
Thank God. It keeps me employed.
Tom Dakin, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Joy, thank you.
Tom Dakin is a reporter who covers commercial development for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he regularly joins us to talk about real estate in the Milwaukee area. You can find more of our conversations at WUWM.com. Coming up, we talk with Dr. Joe Handelsman of UW-Madison about the erosion crisis facing our soil and what we can do to reverse it. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Of the many climate crises we face, soil erosion isn't usually on the top of people's lists. But perhaps it should be. Without topsoil, we can't grow food, and without food, civilizations collapse. The U.S. Department of Agriculture estimates that our agricultural soil erodes at an average rate of almost 5 tons of topsoil per acre per year. In contrast, soil regenerates at less than 1/10 of that rate. Farming practices contribute to the loss, as does global warming. But our next guest says we can fix it. Dr. Joe Handelsman is the director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery at UW-Madison, and she's a research professor in the Department of Plant Pathology. She'll be delivering a talk on soil preservation at the Milwaukee Public Museum Thursday evening. She joins Lake Effect's Bonnie North from her office in Madison to explain how farming practices are contributing to soil loss.
The main thing we're doing is what soil is generally used for, which is crop production. And the methods that humans have used for crop production for literally thousands of years are very destructive to the structure of the soil and make it very vulnerable to erosion. So it's not something that is unique to modern farming. And in fact, many civilizations over thousands of years of history of agriculture have collapsed because they have eroded their soil, and their soil has been destroyed by plowing, which is the main destructive technique we use, and then exposure to hard rain and wind that will take the soil away. We know better now. We know how to preserve soil, and that's the happy part of the story, is that we're losing our soil very rapidly, but we could turn that around in a very short period of time if we put our minds to it.
So plowing, as you say, is the primary way we plant crops. What should we be doing differently that would allow us to still plant and grow food without destroying the very thing that's allowing us to grow the food?
Well, there are three techniques in farming that are well known and very widely used, but not widely enough. And the first is no-till planting, which is where the seeds are actually drilled into last year's crop residue, so, you know, the stubble or whatever's left over from last year, and the soil is never broken up and turned. It's just it receives the seed with this drill. That was a method developed years ago and is used, ironically, more in other countries than in the United States. I think of our agricultural land, about a third or less is under no-till conditions, whereas in Brazil, three-quarters of their cropland is no-till. So that's one that we could switch to, and there are barriers for farmers for all of these, so I'm not minimizing that, but these are the methods that will work. The second is cover crops, which hold the soil in place when we're not growing anything for crop production in it. So in Wisconsin, for example, we will often harvest the crop in the fall. Some farmers will plow after harvest, and then there will be nothing, it's just bare soil until planting in the spring. And so for 7 or 8 months a year, that soil can be bare, and we should never have bare soil. That makes it so vulnerable to removal by wind and water. So cover crops are crops that are planted usually in the fall and cover the land over the winter. Some of those can be plowed back in the spring if plowing is done, or just left to decompose, and then they add fertility to the soil. Some can be turned into crops and used for profit. And then the third method is to intercrop, which means planting the very deep-rooted prairie plants that formed the great soils of the Midwest in the first place, interspersed with the crop plant. And so there are some wonderful experiments that show that if you simply take 10% of the corn out of production and replace it with these deep-rooted prairie plants, that is sufficient to reduce erosion 95%, essentially knocks it down to almost insignificant.
You talked about barriers to this. Are they economic barriers? Are they labor barriers? What is preventing farmers, if we know that this is happening and we want to prevent it from happening, what's preventing us from fixing it?
Well, the big challenge is really economic. Farmers don't have enough of a margin, a profit margin, to suddenly adopt a whole new set of practices that will cost some initial capital investment or some other kind of investment. And they just don't have that leeway in the economics of farming. And so we need to have some sorts of systems that will help farmers get over that initial barrier, because all of these methods will ultimately pay for themselves, but they may require, for example, with no-till farming, you need the drill. So that's a capital investment to do the planting. Or you, for example, in the intercropping, there's a quirk in our crop insurance system where if a farmer says, I'm going to plant 10% less corn this year, and instead of that 10%, I'm going to plant these deep-rooted prairie plants that will nourish my soil, that's a great thing to do for the long term, and corn yields will probably go up within 2 to 3 years. But by taking 10% of the corn out of production, that will reduce the farmer's crop insurance by 10%. Well, that's a risk we can't ask our farmers to take. So there are some systematic problems that get in the way of farmers doing that. That being said, there are many farmers in Wisconsin and other states who have adopted all of these methods and other very innovative methods to restore or build soil.
Do farmers who are focusing on organic farming methods go to this a little more readily, or is it across the board, whether they're using more traditional agriculture or more organic-based?
There is more of a tendency of organic farmers to use these methods, definitely.
So what can consumers do to help farmers adopt these practices?
Well, it's very hard as an individual to find out where your food is grown and under what conditions. Certainly things like community-supported agriculture is one way that people do that, where they can actually meet the farmers and ask about methods that they're using. But I think we need something much broader at a national level and a consumer movement for soil-safe farming. And so my proposal is that if we had a sticker that's like the organic stickers, that if you're certified soil safe, you could put this soil safe certification on your food product, then consumers could decide whether they're willing to pay a small premium to support farmers who conduct soil safe farming. I think all we would need is some of the wholesalers for, you know, major food suppliers to get on board in order to make this profitable for farmers.
Well, we did that with organic foods, certainly, and with the whole farm to table and the idea. And I mean, I'm old enough to remember, you know, when food co-ops first really started in the 60s and 70s, and for a long time it was a niche thing, but it isn't anymore. It seems to be everywhere. And I can't imagine that we couldn't use the same sort of methods to ensure the soil safety as well.
I think a great place to start is in meat production, because most of the most destructive farming is done with corn and soybeans, and those aren't grown for direct human consumption. Those are our Midwestern feed crops for animals. And so what if we started with soil-safe meat, which would mean that the meat had been produced with animals fed corn or soybeans, any kind of grains that were grown on land that was managed in a soil-safe way. I think that would create a premium type of meat, which I think the meat industry might even be looking for right now, because, you know, meat is under all sorts of criticism to begin with because of health issues and climate change issues. And I think the industry or parts of it may be looking for new ways to market their product in a way that sounds more environmentally friendly, which being soil safe certainly would be. That might be a place to start, because you're absolutely right. We've done this before. And the question is, where do you start and how do you get the consumer on board for it?
From a scientific perspective, if we don't do soil-safe farming, what are we looking at in the near and then distant future?
Well, it's going to vary across our crop acreage, but across the United States, the average soil loss on our agricultural land is about 4 tons of soil per acre per year is lost. Now, soil is produced at about one-tenth that rate. So it doesn't take a lot of math to figure out that that's not sustainable, that we're using the soil up, we're removing it from the land 10 times faster than it's being regenerated. But within that average across the United States, there's enormous variation, and there will be areas where there's no soil loss and then areas where there's quite enormous soil loss. And in fact, there have been some tracking of soil loss experiments in Iowa that have shown that not only does Iowa as a state, the average exceeds that national average, they're at almost 6 tons per acre, but there are areas that in recent years, because of the very high precipitation and severe rainstorms with these high momentum raindrops hitting the soil, which is very destructive to the soil, there are areas of Iowa that have lost 50 tons of soil in a single acre in a day because of one storm. And that's 10 times the average of soil loss for the state. And that's in a single day. So the concern is that, first of all, weather that is destructive to soil, those just extremely hard precipitation events are increasing quite rapidly. And they have been for the last 50 years, and it looks like they're going to increase in frequency at an even higher rate going forward. So we're putting the soil under more stress with the current climate trends, but some areas are already losing soil so fast that they will be out of soil in the very near future. So if you fly over the Midwest, you can actually see areas where there's no more surface soil, topsoil, and you can see the subsoil peeking through, which is the mineral layer that isn't really fit for growing crops. there's some evidence that pretty large tracts of land in the Midwest have already gotten to that state. And in the areas that are steeply sloped and are losing soil at a very high rate, we're going to see substantial acreages that have lost all of their topsoil by 2025, 2030. And then if we keep going at this rate, by 2050, I think we'll be in an extremely severe soil loss condition.
It sounds like Dust Bowl times 1,000.
Yes, that's right. And what we're experiencing now, which is a little bit different from the Dust Bowl, is that it's not just the drought that caused the Dust Bowl, but it's now both drought, which can cause soil loss in areas like Kansas and Oklahoma and where the Dust Bowl was at its worst, but now it's also heavy precipitation that is a serious problem. And at the time of the Dust Bowl, we weren't seeing these trends of increasing frequency of these heavy precipitation events. So now there are actually two forces driving soil loss at an increasing rate, and that's both the wind and water erosion.
Well, it sounds like we have a lot to do in a very short amount of time.
I agree, but what I think is the great news about this topic is that we have the means and the knowledge and the scientific wherewithal to fix it. And unlike some of the other global issues that we're dealing with today, where it's very hard to imagine a quick fix with soil loss, we can fix this and soil can be regenerated. And so if we stop eroding it and start building it, we can be in a much better place in terms of the condition of our soil in a very short time.
Well, Dr. Joe Handelsman, it has been such a pleasure having you on Lake Effect. We look forward to having you in Milwaukee on the 16th at the Milwaukee Public Museum. But thank you again for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, and I look forward to being in Milwaukee.
Dr. Joe Handelsman is a research professor and the director of the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery at UW-Madison. She'll be discussing soil erosion this Thursday evening at the Milwaukee Public Museum as part of their Science on Tap series. There's more information at WUWM.com. Coming up next, our Beats Me segment explores the cultural experience of being Black and male in Milwaukee. Lake Effect returns in a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. We turn now to our latest installment of Beat Me. It's our series that lets you ask questions that WUWM's beat reporters will explore. Today, race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell takes a listener's question that asks about the cultural experience of being Black and male in Milwaukee.
Milwaukee has been called one of the most segregated cities in America and one of the worst places for Black people to live and raise their families. With this in mind, today's Beats Me question put me in the position to try and offer some insight into what the experience of being Black and male is in Milwaukee. Of course, there isn't one Black experience. So I sat down with four Black males of different ages and professions to discuss this. I talked to a high school senior, a medical student, an ACLU organizer, and Keith Stanley. Stanley, a third-generation Sherman Park resident and executive director of the Near West Side Partners, takes us outside of Milwaukee to explain his perspective.
I bring up my experience going to HBCU, so going to Alabama State University. And I say that because when I went to Alabama State University many moons ago, that was the first time I experienced being an individual. But I was Keith, not a Black boy or young Black man or a tall Black guy or a bald-headed Black guy. I didn't experience that before. And growing up in Milwaukee, you are Black, then you are whatever. Not to say that's bad, but being able to go somewhere where you are free of that label.
He says this allowed him to see his place in the world as a human and not as a person associated with a group. DeWante Shuford, who grew up in the south suburbs of Chicago, talks about the culture shock that came with going from always being around people who looked like him to going through undergrad and now medical school here in predominantly white institutions, being the only or one of few Black people in a space.
You're being looked upon by everybody, and because of that, you feel like you have to be the best because you are the representative of the Black community. And that can bring a lot of pressure on you, or it could just make you stronger and just say, yeah, I am the representative of the Black community, that I can keep up, outcompete, that I can do just as well as anybody else.
That was a theme everyone agreed with. In some shape or form, they've been looked at as the depiction of an entire group of people and have had to overcome other skepticism that they can do just as well as anyone else. But it was this comment from 17-year-old Devontae Himes, the youngest of the group, that I noticed made the room go quiet for a second.
In high school here, like, you got these teachers that'll call you dumb in your face. Like, I honestly had one my freshman year. She was just like, I don't need you in my class. It ain't like you go be nothing. Like, just get out, you know, so. Yeah, I just never felt welcome in school.
Even so, it seems that Himes' good experiences outweigh the bad because he says Milwaukee will forever be home, no matter how welcoming or non it is to him. But this part of his reality briefly turned the conversation into this group acknowledging that many institutions aren't designed for Black people to succeed. Jared English, who also grew up in Sherman Park, responded to Himes rather disappointed.
When I hear something like that, you know, it makes me very, very sad. But, you know, I also see a great deal of truth in it. When it comes to, like, my experience, and I'm, how old are you, if you don't mind me asking?
17.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah, I'm 37. And so, like, my experience in school was not that. And, you know, that being the case, you know, it goes to what everyone said. Like, you know, there's a lot of things that just simply aren't built for us. But that being the case, you know, we still need to be able to survive and take advantage of what's here.
English says this is one example of how business and political leaders in the city and region have failed to meet the needs of people of color specifically for years, and that needs to change. It's hard to sum up more than an hour of conversation I had with this group, but what I learned is that support from different entities like mentors, family, and the whole community helped making navigating Milwaukee and the world as a Black man a bit easier. And while they agree that it's important for outsiders to hear these realities, they say it's more important that conversations like these continue to happen among Black men so that the Black community can be stronger because of it. Taryn Powell, 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Support for Race and Ethnicity Reporting is provided by the Doman Company Foundation.
Beats Me is a regular feature on Lake Effect. If you have a question for WUWM's beat reporters, let us know at wuwm.com/beatsme. We'll take one last break, then learn more about a local tonic company that's truly of note. Lake Effect returns in just a moment on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Joy Powers. Whether you're participating in Dry January or drinking alcohol, tonics and other mixers can be a great way to satisfy your palate. Top Note Tonic has been supplying Milwaukeeans with their artisanal mixers since 2014, and they recently expanded their operation into Octopi Brewing Company in Wanakee. Mary Pelletieri is the co-founder of Top Note Tonic, and a lot has changed in the world of beverages since she was last on Lake Effect in 2016. Pelletieri recently joined Audrey Nowakowski in studio to discuss new drinking trends, and she begins by explaining some basic information about tonics.
Well, the word tonic is being used more for other types of beverages, but the original term came from kind of an herbal concoction that was good for the body. It toned the body, so to speak, so it was good for digestion. From that, tonic water eventually was created, but it was originally an herbal medicine that was used during World War I to help prevent malaria from taking effect on the soldiers, and the English liked it better with some sparkling water and some gin. So tonic water took off. Of course, that herbal medicine was quinine, which is the bitter that we now know is kind of the tonic water flavor, but that bitter is actually was considered good for digestion originally too. And then of course there's other bitters that can be used in beverages these days, and we know those as bitters and they're old fashioned, but those same things are, you know, also can be used to be a tonic. They used to walk into a bar, I guess pre-prohibition and probably during prohibition, and ask for a sarsaparilla soda tonic, and they'd actually add bitters to it. So it was considered something good for digestion originally. Now we have tonic water, but with kind of the advent of craft cocktailing.
Yeah, it's kind of its own category now, right?
You've seen more tonic waters come to the stores, and that's actually out of a European market. We see a lot of those, but you know, we're here in Milwaukee, and we've been innovating really since 2016 on craft cocktail syrups, tonic syrups, and now we're in sparkling version with our tonic water and two other mixers. We have a ginger beer and a grapefruit soda here too. So
now, and your personal background was in craft brewing, and you've kind of transitioned that over to the world of craft cocktails. For you, how does this feed your creativity when it comes to helping to create new drinks that craft beer either didn't offer you, or you just found a different way to use what you'd learned in the craft brewery world to here?
Yeah, I actually wanted to get out of beer and get more into the non-alcoholic space. I did think adult soft drinks as a category just hadn't been really looked upon. The whole mixer category is really an adult soft drink space. And you can mix, obviously, these with or without alcohol. A lot of people drink tonic on its own, believe it or not. And actually, if you go to Europe, you'll see that people are drinking tonic as a soft drink at lunch. So I saw it as an opportunity to use some of my knowledge from beer in terms of bitter flavor and versatility, as well as just having an ability to make a beverage that's well-balanced and go into a space that hasn't seen innovation in probably 60 years, actually since tonic water first came out commercially. No one's really innovated around the whole mixer category, but it's happening now. So, and we're just one of many brands, I think, out there. Of course, we're a local brand, a Midwest-based, and have a little bit of different roots going with us. So we feel like we make a highly competitive but also quite tasty product.
As you mentioned, there is the rise of alcohol-free drinks, and even the rise of dry bars are becoming more popular. So have you found that this just naturally fits into what you were aiming for from the beginning, or have you altered the way you're thinking of your flavors to appeal to people who are perhaps, even if they do drink alcohol, are leaning towards maybe just not drinking as regularly?
Yeah, or drinking less, right? There's a movement for low proof as well. But no proof, low proof cocktailing is only getting started. I like to look at it as just a different way of imbibing. Where craft beer went was into low proof craft beers. They were really high proof originally, and then they kind of slowly tapered down the alcohol, and I still see that happening. Now we're even seeing no proof craft beers come out, so no alcohol craft beers. That's only happening in the cocktail space too, and mixers play a massive role in that, so we're really happy to be in this category at this time because it does allow us to start to kind of consider the category differently. And yeah, we think more adult-like in our flavor profiles, so what would an adult like to drink? What would taste good with or without alcohol? Or what tastes good with, you know, maybe even just some juicing? You can put a celery press or, you know, a cucumber in our ginger beer and it tastes great. You know, so what's great with or without alcohol? And if the beverage base, the mixer, is actually well balanced, it will stand up to just about anything.
One trend I wanted to pick your brain about is the explosion of hard seltzers this past year. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, everyone's talking about it. And hard seltzer is really just a trend upon a trend upon a trend. I mean, it started with Bartles and James and wine coolers years ago, if anyone remembers those. And frankly, wine coolers are just coming around again as wine cocktails ready to drink. But yeah, it's a trend that the beer industry always sees. Probably about every 5 years, there's a whole new trend of these alcopops. The difference here is, and I've told a lot of people my thoughts, if you looked at the diet soda category, we had sparkling ice take off, and that was an actually diet soda with flavor. And a lot of people thought, what happened to Diet Coke? Well, and then Diet Coke came out with flavors and kind of retook the category, and sparkling ice has died back a bit, not as popular as it used to be. I think the same thing will happen with light beer and this sparkling category that is essentially light beer. It's actually fermented cane sugar. I remind people of that every day. It's still made in breweries. And just because of a strange labeling law, they actually have to put the nutritional facts on it. So it's it's still beer.
Yeah.
It's just made with sugar and
some
flavor.
People look at the can and say, you know, brewed beverage. It's like, well, what?
You know? I'm sure at some point the TTB and the FDA are going to get together on this and start creating some different labeling requirements. But it's exploding. I mean, I see craft brewers wanting to get into it. It's because cocktails are so popular. So I see it as a good thing for us. I think it does hurt the light beer industry more than anything. A lot of people are trading to those brands and those types of beverages versus light beer. But cocktails are still very popular. 43% of the liquor aisle right now is premium. And that part of the liquor category continues to grow because people are just simply trading up. They might be drinking less, but they're trading up for it. And that means they're going to make a better cocktail. And people have many times told us, I thought I didn't like gin, but it turns out I didn't like the tonic.
There we go. Yeah. And that is an interesting re-education for people, right? Because typically they're thinking, here's this clear, bland tasting carbonated thing that I'm going to mix with something that I enjoy. You
right,
know? And
right.
You're flipping the table a little bit.
Right. People think tonic water doesn't have calories. It does have calories. You should watch the calories. You should watch the sugar. You should look at the ingredients it's made with. The commoditized soft drinks that people find in the mixer aisle. By the way, only 5% of the mixers in this country are considered premium. So we've got a massive gap to fill to what people are actually buying in the spirits line. But the commoditized soft drinks that people are buying are just, they're not worth the cost of the liquor that you're mixing it with. So I always try to encourage folks to actually look at the ingredients labels of what they're buying.
Well, you were kind enough to bring in some top note products and recipes for mixers. So how about we get into
that? Sure. Yeah, I'm going to do just three really simple cocktails. Something Top Note is really all about is we say create your own clever, right? So create your own cocktail because everyone can be clever in cocktailing. You don't have to be a mixologist to make a great cocktail. You just need great ingredients. And I'm going to start with our classic tonic since we've talked a lot about tonic. I'm going to make you a simple gin and tonic. I've got Rayhorse Gin here, which is a very nice gin made right here in Milwaukee. I highly recommend people keep this as kind of their standard gin on their bar. And I'm just going to mix an ounce and a half of the gin and the rest tonic water, and you will see how good it tastes.
Cool.
And some people really like the taste of the lime on top of the tonic. If you're looking at a lower proof cocktail, Highball is it. It's not going to just wow you with alcohol. It's going to be something that you can kind of consume, maybe pre-meal. It's a nice thing to make when you're making dinner, I think, if you have guests around. It's very simple, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, here you are, a pro. You made a great tasty cocktail, which she's just slugging down, I have to
you
admit.
You know, you can talk, I'll drink.
The challenge with a really good Highball is we used to call it in the industry Moorish. You want more of it too quickly.
Right.
Some people call it, you know, these a little too good, but that's okay. I think, you know,
well,
all in.
I'm feeling like I'm tasting more of the tonic aftertaste.
Yeah. Okay, so this next one, we're going to use the Twisted Path rum. I love this rum, and Brian Sammons, who's a phenomenal distiller, he's all organic, grain to glass. He's been in our same building as the Lincoln Warehouse as we have been ever since we started. So when we found out a distillery was downstairs, we had to kind of take up residence there. Yeah, and they've long, you know, supported us. So we like to pour with Twisted Path, and he's just done some rebranding. He's got some beautiful bottles out there now. But his rum, his barrel-aged rum, has always been one of my favorites. Just a beautiful rum. Nice color. And then, of course, it goes well with the ginger beer, which is a Dark and Stormy, classically made. And I'm going to just put a little bit of the Bitter Cube orange bitters on top, which is a little not classic, but it might kind of create a bit of more of an enhanced cocktail for you here.
I admit, I don't tend to do ginger beer things, so I'm curious to try it.
Okay. Well, Dark and Stormy, I think, is great with our ginger beer specifically. Because it's got date sugar in it, it's dark, and it kind of brings out that barrel of...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is good. Like, usually ginger beer for me is too bitey, too... Uh-huh. You know, spicy's not the right word, but it
is
overwhelms.
The right word. Actually,
yeah.
It is spicy. Yeah. Ginger spicy. And ginger beers can be too spicy. They actually have too much heat in them, right?
It's yeah, too much where you can't concentrate on enjoying and drinking it because it feels like a bit of a chore to keep going, you know? Yeah.
By the way, orange bitters, you know, all in, these are, this is providing you not necessarily bitter, but it's providing you some orange aroma and top notes. So I think
that made a great difference. Yeah. Yeah, I really like that.
So you can make a dark and stormy. I think if it had a slice of orange, you'd see how even better it would be. But this is fun. These are simple, again, just clever little twists on standards. And with a great mixer, anyone can really do this. The last one I'm going to leave you with is kind of has become a favorite of our one of our brands that we do a lot with is Koval Spirits, and they're out of Chicago, female owned company, and I love doing stuff with them because they really embrace the highball. They understand that consumers really do want something simple to make at home, but they buy a nice bottle of Koval, they're actually going to want a really nice cocktail. So why not buy a slightly more expensive grapefruit soda to mix it with. So I'm actually going to do Koval Rye with Top Note Tonic Grapefruit Soda. Very simple. So this is a rye.
Yeah, all of these are just the two ingredients, except with the bitters, the orange bitters. Yeah.
Yeah, this is almost a rye sour. So we like to say our grapefruit can be used as a sour. So if people are making old fashions, they can use this as a sour. But I will share this one with you. So when a distillery comes to you and says, we love using your product, you got to believe them. And they use this as kind of a standard to show off their rye. So rye is usually peppery, and it just happens to go really nicely with grapefruit.
That is really good. Isn't the whiskey blends almost seamlessly where you don't have that whiskey forwardness. It's all just kind of one refreshing grapefruit note.
It's a great way of kind of showing off whiskey or even a dark spirit. It almost tastes like a rye sour. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, all of these are super delicious and simple
for
us who maybe don't have a ton of experience making cocktails at home. But Mary, I want to thank you so much for coming in and sharing these with us.
Thank you. I appreciate you guys taking the time to taste these. It's fun being in this industry, and it's really fun sharing how simple this can be.
Mary Pelletieri is the co-founder of Top Note Tonic. She joined Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in the studio, and you can find more information and recipes of the drinks she made in this segment at WUWM.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and please join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh air is next.